Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. America has always meant more than one thing, a country as it came to be and a culture, but also the countries and cultures of a hemisphere. Now, American art is turning to that wider palette and maybe taking with it the American identity. Museums from Dallas to Los Angeles to now Boston have stretched the canvas, put Paul Revere silver next to Lakota war plumes, next to Mayan sculpture, next to Jackson Pollock. It's breathtaking, it's beautiful, it may stretch our understanding of who we are. This hour On Point, reframing American art. You can join the conversation. What makes art American to you? Is it a geography of origin, a culture? Are you ready to blur the lines, to stretch them? You can also comment at Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now in the studio is Elliot Bostwick Davis, chair of the Art of the Americas Department at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts, where they've just opened an astonishing new $345 million Art of the Americas wing. You can see a terrific gallery of photos from the new wing at our website, onpointradio.org. Elliot Bostwick Davis, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
And with us in the studio, Andrew McClellan, professor of art history at Tufts University. His books include The Art Museum, From Boulay to Bilbao, and Art and Its Public. Andrew McClellan, thanks very much to you for being with us as well.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Elliot, I mean, I know this is not the first time, and thanks to Christopher Knight, the Los Angeles Times, who in his piece about your new wing, amazing new wing, points out that Dallas has stretched this canvas, the Los Angeles County Museum of Art has stretched this canvas, many other museums at this point. This is maybe interesting because you're doing it in Boston, which is in many ways the home of so much American identity, Paul Revere and the Tea Party and the Minutemen and all the rest. We were in this museum, this new wing, yesterday. It is amazing. What are you up to here with making this the Art of the Americas wing? Not American art. It's all in there.
I think so many people think of the Boston Collections as iconic for the art of our nation, and Boston is that cradle of liberty where the revolution really got started. So, of course, Paul Revere and his Liberty Bowl are front and center, but they're now in a whole new magnificent context, much broader sweep from 900 BC all the way up through about the third quarter of the 20th century.
Take us back to the beginnings of this. I mean, now it's a beautiful new wing, incredible kind of coming on string at this time of economic distress coming on stream now. You must have done a lot of fundraising back when times were very good indeed. But what was the intent of this kind of presentation where you've got, beautiful, pre-Columbus masks here in the same new wing and, you know, sort of cheek by jowl with early tables of the Puritans and furniture and artifacts and Paul Revere and George Washington in huge display and all the rest. What's the conceptual intent?
I came to the museum really as part of Malcolm Rogers' vision to really create a whole department for the Americas.
So North Central. This is the director of the Boston Museum of Fine Arts.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And so in 2001, my mandate was really with our whole team of curators and educators and designers and, of course, the architects themselves to flesh out this vision for the new Art of the Americas wing that would open in 2010. So we were, from the beginning, rethinking our collections from the start and from scratch within the perimeter that we had available to us. So we ended up creating the indigenous peoples of the Americas, the ancient and Native Americans, as the foundations for the successive generations of Americans, many of them, of course, immigrants to this country that would follow.
Andrew, you've seen the new wing.
Yes.
Your overall impression of it?
Fabulous. It's a huge landmark, I think, across the landscape of our country in terms of what museums are doing with their collections. I might to say that in addition to a horizontal stretching of boundaries where we now have an inclusive vision of a continent, we also have a more vertical integration of the arts with high art masterpieces on the one hand mixing cheek by jowl with everyday objects. So Copley paintings on the one hand, anonymous scrimshaw and women's samplers on the other. So I think there are two kinds of integration going on here that really are unique in their combination.
Breaking down walls in a lot of directions. And if you're in Boston and you've seen it, or if you're anywhere in the country and you've seen it, let us hear from you. If you haven't, we hope you get a chance to. You may have seen something similar going on in museums in your hometown, anywhere around the country. Here's just a brand new and quite amazing example of it. The things, the objects in this museum, high art or everyday objects, it's not as though they haven't been in museums. They have, Andrew. But here, I mean, do you see this conceptual statement in putting them all in this one wing, often very nearly cheek by jowl? What does it say about what it means when we think of American art? Are we at the point in our history now where we burst the frame of, European colonization and settlement and all the rest, and can throw our arms around the whole, the pre-Columbian and Jackson Pollock, in all in one great big expanse?
Sure. I think it's a beginning towards that end. Or, as you say, there are other museums that have been doing similar things over the years. But we might point out that Boston has one of the two greatest collections of pre-war American art in this country. So what's going on here carries symbolic weight. And moreover, I think it's also important to remember that, you know, for Americans, museums are where they encounter art. You know, unlike Europe or Asia, we don't have grand cathedrals and princely palaces.
A few, not so many.
Not so many.
Hearst Castle.
Yes, that's true, which are museums now themselves.
Right.
But the public, by and large, has its collective notion of what is art shaped by museums. And so what museums do in this respect, how they represent America, takes on added importance, I think. And so the expansive embrace of a continent is a paradigm shift.
Elliot, some will have been here already, others not. Paint a picture for us, that suggests in different objects or works of art here, the extent, the expanse, sort of maybe from the ground floor, or I should say the ground floor.
Please.
Up. If you start with pre-Columbian, if we're standing here, give us a sense of the range. Just play it on out for us of what we're going to be observing, looking at.
So, Tom, when you were with me yesterday and you came right into ancient Americas, I think you were struck by how extraordinary those enormous Quiche burial urns were. They almost stand 5 feet tall. They're arranged in a large pyramidal group. And the whole purpose was to communicate with people visually and dramatically to say, you're in a different place. You're in the ancient Americas now. These are from works from about 750 AD, and they are unbelievable.
A struck doesn't begin to capture it. I was blown away by the beauty, the singularity of these objects. They were burial urns or burial, I don't know, there's, I mean, they're just gorgeous. They
have
sculpture.
Jaguars on top of them. They have all sorts of figures that are meaningful in the shaman kinds of cultures of transformation. Of course, birth and rebirth, a big part of the Maya universe. And I think most people, if they are lucky enough to encounter ancient American art, often see it in the context of, quote, primitive parts of the museum in different ways. It's separated from the fine art. And, of course, we deliberately, our whole team, felt very strongly that ancient Americas and Native American art, those people working in the Americas from prehistory and later, and in the case of Native Americans, right up to the 20th century, we have artists who define themselves in terms of their own Native heritage, and we've included those contemporary Native Americans.
But you start right there with these incredible urns. You've got gold work around them, which is spectacular. The sophistication of these pre-Columbian objects is just tremendous.
We have works with vessels that have hieroglyphs around them called glyphs. People know Egyptian hieroglyphs. This is a different form of writing. It was a highly sophisticated culture in the Maya universe. They knew all about astronomy. They had sophisticated court rituals. They had portraiture of their own. And now it's in this much broader context of the fine arts, and as Andrew's pointed out, the realm of arts of all sorts, not just the high arts, but all the arts and more ordinary objects that have been made.
Now, just on the flanks of these extraordinary pre-Columbian pieces, you'll have, for example, pieces from the Puritan in New England, and the contrast is kind of wild. They were coming onto into a hemisphere where there had been very sophisticated life for a long time and culture, and they were making do with what they could hew out of the nearest tree.
That's right. We place the ancient peoples in the front and center in the spine, and then off of that, our collection of ship models, which includes, of course, European and American vessels, to make the point that the Americas were separated by these great oceans that mm-hmm. many of the colonists traveled to. And then our collection moves forward into the 17th century, the beginnings of New England and the colonies here, many Anglo-Americans coming to this country and hewing out from those timbers the frames you saw and the period rooms and furniture that you saw there.
Describe a few key pieces from that period.
We had one enormous 50-foot beam that came from a house, the Manning House of Ipswich, Massachusetts, which is north of Boston. It's 49 feet. It weighs about 800 pounds, and the whole building had to be built around it. But we freed it up from the 20s when it was then displayed with plaster and added windows and doors not original to the house, so the frame can stand in all its glory, and you can really look at what these architects and those same artisans that made the architecture often made the furniture of that period. So you can really get a good look at it.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a new framing of American art as art of the Americas, the art of a hemisphere of the new world. Elliot Bostwick Davis is with us from Boston's Museum of Fine Arts. They've just opened an enormous new wing there, kind of a big jewel of a wing, Art of the Americas, 50,000 plus square feet, $345 million new statement on American art, or Art of the Americas, if you will. Andrew McClellan is with us as well. He's professor of art history at Tufts University. He's been there. I was there yesterday. It's quite something. Dallas did something like this back in the 90s. Los Angeles has done it, others as well. But it brings into very clear view a kind of shifting frame of what American art is. Let's go to our listeners. Sean in Worcester, Massachusetts. Sean, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks so much, Tom, for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I want to come to the fact that I was recently, a few weeks ago, at the L.A. County Museum of the Art. I had the opportunity in particular to view their exhibits from the Americas, but particularly their Latin American exhibits were quite astonishing. And I also wanted to, I've seen the promotional materials for the new MFA exhibit, although I haven't been yet. I'm looking forward to going.
In Boston,
but
yeah.
I just wanted to say that I think this is kind of part of a broader, you know, re-understanding of American art that really took place in Mexico probably close to 100 years ago with Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo, you know, obsessed with this new construction of Mexican identity. And that's something that I really don't feel like we've had in this, you know, in our current artistic environment, you know, up until the present day in America. Particularly, like, I'm a jazz musician, and, you know, I understand the music that I play is intrinsically American and kind of, you know, you mentioned earlier about questions of European, you know, colonial identity, and I think in a lot of ways we really haven't shed those, I don't want to call them shackles, but, you know, maybe intellectual shackles in the same way that a place like Mexico has. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, Sean, it's great to hear from you and the report from Los Angeles there. Elliot Bostwick Davis, I mean, you know, what about it? How far do you go here? When you've got Paul Revere, in the same wing and not far from Latin American, you know, what are you saying? Are you consciously saying, well, you know, there has been a dominant culture within the political confines of a particular country, the United States, but now things are shifting. We're recognizing ourselves as somehow citizens in a broader sense of a broader swath in artistic terms. You know, are Diego Rivera and Frida Kahlo telling us something here? Are they speaking to the new framing that you're giving in this wing?
Absolutely. We are thrilled that we have a gallery for the Art of New Spain, so some key objects from the colonial past of Mexico, the Archbishop of Mexico by the foremost painter of Mexico, Miguel Cabrera, from 1754, and an outstanding, probably one of the finest pieces of furniture to ever come out of Mexico, and a writing desk called an escritorio with a map of a town, San Ildefonso, on the front engraved, that one from 1650. But I'm thrilled also that this project will enable us to continue to build on the momentum. And we have two exhibitions coming online by two of our very talented curators in the department. Heather Hole is working on this very topic of national modernism in Mexico and the United States from 1920 to 40. Of course, we're not able to export objects that we would love to have in the wing, like Mexican murals, because they're part of the cultural patrimony of Mexico.
Mm-hmm.
But that that study of that influence of the Diego Riveras working here in New York, but also the artists in the United States going to Mexico and exploring much of modernism there, will be exactly what Heather will be looking at as these two national forms of art really emerge in the early 20th century. And another curator, Dennis Carr, is working on Asia and the New World in the colonial period, and Mexico will figure heavily in that show as well. So thrilled to be able to present those down the road at the museum.
Andrew, what's your understanding of political boundaries and art, nationalism and art? I mean, do they mix? Does art ever follow national lines? You know, Europe's been, they've had countries and cultures cheek by jowl for a long time. Maybe there's a pan-European sense of art, but at the same time, a national sense of art. In the New World, in this hemisphere, are we seeing a kind of changing understanding, you know, an openness to a shared culture across political boundaries when it comes to art?
I think so. I hope so. I think that the structure of art history as a discipline going back hundreds of years has been built around artificial notions of school, of nationality, for reasons of nationalism, and that's been enshrined in national museums across Europe. But there's always been a sense in which there was fluidity working across national boundaries through the paradigm of influence. And, you know, in the Americas wing, what we have is a sense of being able to encounter those differences and changes. Even the American wing links up to the European wing, so we don't lose that sense of continuity between the European and the American art. It's more a question of creating opportunities, I think, to explore and to think about these encounters in space. I mean, I would just add, I think one of the successful things about the wing is the way in which we have spatial treatment of these different stories in art. So take the Paul Revere, fantastic opening moment, and it flows straight through.
Where you see the great Liberty Bowl, and right behind it, the great and famous portrait of Paul Revere, chin in hand, kind of contemplating the future of, well, maybe this continent.
Absolutely, and it's one of the fantastic flows, spaces, you might say, in an American museum now. You really feel the thrust and the power of colonial America, but you work crossways across the space, and the architect has made these openings, and you get alternative visions. You have the sense of a dominant Anglo tradition, perhaps complicated by side stories around the outside, and that's a very exciting thing, I think, that the museum can do for visitors, present these startling encounters, make you think, rethink what you've long assumed, perhaps, about what American art is.
Elliot, here's a comment from the web from Richard. He says, American art is art made by Americans. The question that your wing raises is, well then who are Americans?
And so many of the artists, I think you do need to look at the longer arc. So you often see in the 20th century, after World War II or right around, you've been mentioning Pollock, these artists working in the United States in the 40s and 50s were almost ripe for looking back at their own heritage and looking at the ancient Americans, their iconography. We have an artist like Steve Wheeler and Peter Busa, loosely affiliated with a group called the Indian Space Painters. They loved the work that they saw that Native Americans had created, and they were very inspired by what occurred in ancient American art, as was Joseph Albers, and even in the wing, artists still living like Cesar Paternostro from Argentina, and he's written very eloquently about ancient Andean textiles and the architecture of ancient America that influences his own work. So it may take a while for these bigger arcs to express themselves, but I do think we wanted to indicate those in the wing as well.
Well, I mean, that's the question. When you suggest that big arc, it's not the whole rainbow yet perhaps visible, but you strongly suggest it here. And it raises this question of whether there is something whole here, or is this fragments? Are these different sort of vectors onto a new great big piece of land? Is there a culture, an overarching culture? You know, are you suggesting that with time we will come to see even a common culture? Can such a thing exist between, you know, I don't know, Chippendale furniture and Guatemalan pots?
Well, a lot of people don't realize that even the Liberty Bowl itself, that very simple form, it's something we see often here. If you've ever seen one in a silver shop, it's actually from a Chinese punch bowl form. So even when you're mentioning like a Chippendale chair, the ball and claw form of those chairs where the furniture leg ends in a ball, which is gripped by almost like an eagle's talons, that's something that also is very familiar in Asian art of the Chinese dragons that are often clutching a ball with their talents. Yeah. And so there was a much more global presence, of course, back in the colonial era. People were sailing the world, often getting to Asia via India, Africa, and all over, of course, globally. So I think that's what we've tried to do in the book. We also wrote, all of the curators contributed to A New World Imagined, where it's to really begin to think about these collections now that they're in this space in the wing, but to begin to think about them as a way into what do these objects mean in a much broader sense. So that's what we're hoping to suggest for our visitors, but also our readers.
A kind of bleeding between what we may think of as different motifs, but you're saying, in fact, lots of threads between them. Let's go to London, Kentucky, and Rose. Hi, Rose, you're on the air.
Hi. I just started listening maybe about 10 minutes ago, and I think it was Tom who had said that most people perceive art as it is in the museums. And I wanted to know if your two guests thought it was, if I wanted to know if they really enjoyed, or maybe they thought it was a burden, I don't know, if they think it's, if they enjoy putting things in the museums and kind of molding what, you know, people perceive as art.
Yeah, both what is art, and thank you very much, Rose, for that. What is art, and what is a family of art? In a way, Andrew, anytime a museum does something, it is inevitably sort of shaping a public understanding over time of reality.
Absolutely. And that's where the importance of how you place things spatially and next to each other comes into play, because stories are told, narratives are formed, and so how objects are collected and arranged in space takes on huge importance. And it's one of the exciting things that museums can do is experiment with those narratives and change them and get us to think differently about them. And this is for the general public. Many more people go to museums than read books or attend art history classes in college. So I think what does happen in museums is really important.
Rose asks, you know, not just about politically. In fact, she asked specifically about, you know, what's art. I mean, you pointed to the needlepoint and some of the crafts that are right alongside here in your sort of conceptual notion, a vertical and a horizontal expansion of how we look at art here. It's not just political lines, but in that way, it may be class or gender lines exploded in an exhibit as well.
Absolutely. And that's what I think. For me, that's as exciting an aspect of the new MFA wing as the horizontal look across the continent. I loved seeing those samplers and the bits of scrimshaw. I mean, many museums have the stuff in storage, but they've never, I think, worked out how to include it and to put it next to and put it in play next to masterpieces by Copley and fine pieces of furniture. I love that domestic sense of that sense of wholeness of visual culture, you might say.
We've got needlepoint. We have Navajo objects, but we have very big political statements here as well. I mean, Elliot, describe for us the enormous portrait of George Washington at the Delaware River. Talk about powerful archetypal political iconography. Just paint a word picture of that for us, if you would.
It's an enormous painting. It's 12 feet high by 17 feet wide. It's virtually life-size. It portrays Washington on the banks of the snowy river, the Delaware River, on Christmas night in a courageous effort to surprise the British troops he had hoped were celebrating over the Christmas holiday. So he's engaged his artillery and all of his troops that are remaining now. They've struggled through these battles through New York, and they're really at their wits' end, but they have managed to cross this river. They do surprise the British. They take very few casualties but capture many, and it's really a turning point in the Revolution. Our whole wing on that level, the gallery that follows on the Paul Revere Liberty Bowl and the portrait of Paul Revere, was built to really really feature that painting. So we had to create a ceiling height that we cut out of the ceiling.
It's huge. It looks like the side of a truck.
And it has an enormous frame on it.
Golden frame.
It's gilded, and the corners, the rosettes, are as large as most people's dinner platters for Thanksgiving.
Yeah.
So it's quite extraordinary.
Do you feel a tension between that kind of very large political historical statement then, and, you know, whether Lakota or you name the Native American tribe objects? Of course, they were pushed aside by the very political way that that portrait helps represent. Or, you know, look, California was Mexican. Now
yes,
it's United States of America. I mean, is there not a built-in tension in this? Maybe family of art as well.
Definitely. And I think up on the level two, where we have many of the images of the West painted by an artist like Albert Bierstadt, who studied in Germany, when he returns, he presents these really magically lit, very golden lighted views of the West as this real Eden almost, as
a
recap.
The romantic Rockies.
Yes, mm-hmm. Very much so. So, of course, there are these strands of what's going on in the United States. I think Andrew hit on, though, the broadening of the canon of the kinds of artists. Of course, women artists we've talked about, but many more artists of color that were never part of the traditional mm-hmm. gallery system, and we've worked hard to really represent and build that collection of artists that represent a much broader diversity, many more artists who immigrated to this country as well, artists who are working, even former slaves like Harriet Powers, who produced an unbelievable masterpiece of her appliqué quilt from about 1895. So the breadth is really meant to really ask people about what belongs in an art museum, and furthermore, what, as you say, what really constitutes art of the Americas and the U.S.
Let's get a call from Matt in Petoskey, Michigan. Matt, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good morning. I'm really enjoying this episode. We just had in Arizona the passage of the 1070 law, and in conjunction with that, there were, I believe, several state senators that proposed the ending of the teaching of ethnic studies in the state of Arizona. And I don't know actually whether that law passed or not. But I'm just curious, I'd like to learn from your guest if in this kind of, I would say, increased jingoistic atmosphere, whether the study of Native American history specifically is somewhat threatened in the United States. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Matt, I appreciate your call. Elliot Bostwick Davis, your new wing is in a way a political statement. Did you make it? Knowing that it might be up against a time when, as Matt said, we've had laws in Arizona very tough on immigrants, proposals for dropping ethnic studies around this country in some locales. At the same time, you're making a statement that throws arms around many ethnicities and cultures here. What about that very current political tension? This is not historical. This is right now. Matt calls it jingoism.
I think art has always had a major role in the political arena. Have we gone out to really politicize the conversation? I think the wing is really the catalyst for that. So as you've heard from Matt, I think it's something that is certainly going to inspire many discussions as to what is great about our culture, what do we need to continue to work on, and how are we going to continue these conversations. However, unlike Andrew, I'm not engaged with the actual the teaching of young students, so I would love to hear his point of view on that as well.
What do you say, Andrew? Is this provocative, or is this what your students just presume?
I think it's what they're increasingly coming to presume. I think we, as younger generations especially, recognize the increasing multicultural nature of our country, which has to be reflected in institutions of culture, both universities and museums. So I'm all in favor of this, and I think it's the way of the future.
Are we going to see, though, people saying, wait a minute, why is George Washington in there? Why is Paul Revere in there with, pre-Columbian art? This is different. This is not that's not the way we want to see the Tea Party era.
Well, no one will have any problem with the way in which George Washington and Paul Revere are
they're pretty
forward.
Well positioned.
They
there.
Are well positioned, and that's appropriate. This is the history of Boston and colonial New England in those rooms. But I think we need to expand that vision. So I'm all for blending other cultures in with the mainstream Anglo-American tradition.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a new framing of American art as art of the Americas, the art of a hemisphere of the New World. Elliot Bostwick Davis is with us. She's chair of the Art of Americas Department at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, where they've just added a $345 million great jewel of a new wing, where we see pre-Columbian art and Paul Revere and George Washington and George O'Keefe and Jackson Pollock altogether in quite a terrific new display. You may have seen something like this in a museum in your own region. Andrew McClellan is with us as well, professor of art history at Tufts University. Let's get a call from Yali in St. Petersburg, Florida. Yali, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well.
So I was listening to this conversation, and it just struck me that I think, first of all, that this change in perception and this movement towards a broader view of what is considered American artwork is terrific. And for me, it just got me to thinking that we as a nation have moved from this kind of scrappy, can-do, hodgepodge of immigrants that founded this country to a fat cat resting on our laurels. And that, to some degree, in my mind, is what has caused these greater issues that we're experiencing now in the United States, is that we've just gotten kind of fat and lazy, and that we've lost that ethic, the work ethic. And I don't know, when I put this in the context of art, I see the greater perspective bringing different aspects of the Americas into the fold. I find it pleasing, because I feel like that's really the roots of who we are. We are the melting pot, and I wish that we would get back to that.
Yali, I'm so happy for your call. Thanks very much for it. I mean, there's this question of dynamism in all aspects of life. It always comes up in art as well. Robert Hughes wrote a decade and more ago about what is American art, about what distinguished New World from Old World art. And even then, I think this was 1997, Andrew, he was saying that he felt in the American art sort of project at that point, a kind of a dissipation, kind of like we were past the peak, maybe something like Yali's looking at. I mean, do you see new sources of dynamism in looking at the whole, as we're seeing in this wing?
Absolutely. I think it doesn't really make sense to me to think that we are on a downward trend in terms of artistic creativity. The new Lindy Wing at the Museum of Fine Arts will be opening soon, which will give full voice to the extraordinary production that's going on in this country, and multicultural production it is too, around contemporary art. So there's no diminution of energy, of talent, of product, of vision, you might say, carrying on now, and museums across the country are representing that.
Elliot, here's a couple of web posts. One is from JP. Says, when I think of American art, I think of those artists who introduced the art world to a new, more uniquely American sensitivity. Edward Hopper, Andy Warhol, two examples. I mean, what about the old world, new world divide? Can you point at this, and when you look at the whole, and say there is something new, not just in the geography, but in the artistic sensibility of this hemisphere, this country, this greater culture?
It's interesting that writer mentioned two artists who, of course, came right out of the illustration mode where they had to make a living, both Hopper and mm-hmm. Warhol. And so many artists working in the United States had that issue. They had to make a living. Early on, they might have been shoemakers or saddle makers. And later on, as time went on, they were very much, people who were able to make the most of what they had at hand. So I do think that sense of freedom freed us from the old world of those academies that existed for a long time in both France and England, had a certain mode in Italy as well of training artists, whereas here in this country, our academies and schools were a little more intermittent, even though we founded at the Museum of Fine Arts our own school at the time we began in 1870. So this is very much, I think, part of the underpinning to why these American artists working in the United States felt free, and maybe that even goes back to our freedoms that the Founding Fathers fought for, mm-hmm. that we could combine even creating our own systems of government from whatever we chose. And in the same way, I think, in that, to go back to the earlier caller about the political nature, I think many of these artists felt that sense of freedom to combine the threads into something that would be meaningful for them and for their culture.
But is there a genuine commonality here, Andrew? I mean, after all, these fantastic pre-Columbian works we saw, when those were made, the artisans, the artists who made those, whether it's gold work or that incredible death mask, but quite fantastic, from
Central America,
Central Mexico. They didn't know Europe existed, let alone that it was about to descend on them in all those fleets of ships that are so beautifully, spectacularly modeled here. Can we talk about a commonality, you know, when one world did not even know the other at the outset?
No, I don't think we can. I don't think that there is a point in trying to force a commonality across such a broad range of objects, but rather we should revel in the diversity of voices, you might say, that have been brought to the table across history in the realm of the arts, whether it's samplers on the one hand by African Americans or Jackson Pollock on the other. This is a nation of multiple voices that can all talk side by side under the same roof. That's what I think is going on.
Here's another posting from Paul in New York City. He says, one thing I think most people overlook is the resounding impact of abstract impressionism. Started in New York, 20th century, I think it's like jazz. It was the birth of uniquely American art, wholly self-invented, when Americans detached from European art and surpassed it. Now, you've got examples of this in the exhibit. What about Paul's interpretation, Elliot?
Well, it's very interesting because right now our current exhibition, Fresh Ink, has our work by Pollock, number 10, one of his major drip paintings. I'm sure this is what he's writing about. And it's displayed as an Asian scroll would be, a Chinese scroll. So it's horizontally displayed instead of on the wall vertically. Mm-hmm. And that's what Pollock knew when he was creating these drip paintings. So again, he was very much familiar with forms of calligraphy. He was doing something new with it in terms of creating these large-scale drip paintings and freeing himself in that sense of ways of creating space that had been, you know, all the way going back to the Italian Renaissance of a window onto a world. But I think Pollock is quite familiar with other kinds of trends that were current. And again, he's one of my favorites because he loved looking at Native American and other cultures as well.
So maybe uniquely American, but also there's something just fabulously unique about the American history of pulling from all over the world to create everything nearly that's here at this point. Nicole in Barrington, Rhode Island. Nicole, you're on the air.
Hi, yeah. Just as Pollock was a leader and an American pioneer in the arts, I think that, you know, he had a very unique way of seeing and showed us how to see the world in a special way, just as the works of other cultures do. Mm-hmm. And while each of those things, artists and places are unique, if you look at the work of Joseph Campbell, who studied the mythology of all different cultures throughout mm-hmm. history, you will find that he found common symbolism. So mm-hmm. I think that there's a unifier in what drives people to make art, and that the collection can be instructive in that way, too.
That's terrific, Nicole. I appreciate your call very much. I mean, pulling together common symbolism, it's literally brought to the United States in all the strands of cultures that have ended up here. Josh in Pikeville, Kentucky. Josh, you're on the air.
Yes, hello, Tom.
Hi, what do you know?
I was in Boston back in June and got to visit the museum, and it's an excellent place. I recommend that anybody visit there that happens to be in the area or just the citizens of the town. Mm-hmm. Regrettably, I didn't get to see this exhibit, but I think it's a brilliant idea. I think it's a great theme that really represents the story of the continent and its people, which has been a continent of conflict and with socio-political and different religious ideas. And I just think it's a great way to put it all together and really tell the story of the Americas the way it should be, because it is a conflicting place, even still today, and I just think it's a brilliant idea, and the museum is just a great place, and I'll hopefully get to make it back up there someday.
Josh, we hope you do. It doesn't have to be all harmony for it to be a very potent a blend, and I appreciate your call. Ed in Holliston, Massachusetts. Ed, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call. I really enjoyed listening to the show, and the topic itself is really something that I kind of have a passion for, and that is the overlooked, hidden fabric of this country. You know, we're not all Western, Northern European people here, but most of the big museums would lead you to believe that. I think it's vital for us to have this included in our, you know, our collective demonstration.
Ed, I appreciate that very much. I mean, Elliot, you know, it comes through kind of with every call, with every observer, the importance. It can seem like an elite undertaking. I mean, right now, just the idea of a $345 million museum wing when people don't have jobs. On the other hand, this collectively, these kind of efforts do help draw the very identity, our very understanding of ourselves, as Ed says, which is changing.
Well, this is our culture, and I think it's such a broad breadth. We've been talking about that throughout today, but I think even thinking to this recent call about the artists that are unknown to us today, and many of those artists of ancient America, but going right up to the 20th century, the folk artists, as they're broadly called, they're working with everyday objects. I think, Tom, you pointed that out. They were making the molds for weather vanes right here in Waltham, Mass., one of the great centers for production in the United States, and they were sent out all over the country. But these artists, these men, making and serving manufacturers, we're creating objects of beauty. And I think that's what the wing is about, is this opportunity to see the breadth of so many kinds of artistic expressions that are really as varied as the terrain in the Americas and the peoples themselves.
Andrew, imagine yourself as a European visitor, an old world visitor to this museum. Is there a counterpart in Europe today? I mean, after all, its broader cultural context right across the Mediterranean into Africa, you know, has inspired many Picasso and right on. Is there a counterpart sense of wide-ranging art and cultural range in Europe? Is this something distinctly New World American?
Well, I think that European museums tend to be more tradition-bound in the way in which they organize themselves along the lines of national school and national identity. So the British Museum and the Louvre in Paris will foreground the arts of their own countries in a larger European context. Some museums in Europe don't even have American art. So even within the European context, I think there's a sort of a more traditional view of American art, of their own countries, as well as still a more traditional division between the high arts and the low arts. So I think this is something that's new and perhaps will be of interest to people in Europe.
I mean, will they see here, does it make sense if you're not American, the range, the urns alongside, or does it look like a superimposition? I mean, after all, Europe was a superimposition literally on this country.
Well, I'd like to think that Europeans visiting the museum and the other ones you've mentioned along the way will get a broader sense of what the American experience and the American experiment has been all about. That's what I would like to think they would get.
Talok in Charlestown, Rhode Island. Talok, you're on the air.
Yeah, this is Talok, and I'm calling because I'm listening to your conversation. And I'm curious why Joan Lester, who teaches at Tufts, she teaches art history, was not involved. Probably one of your guests from there would probably know who she is and what she's done. But my reason for calling is you're focusing on the Native American contributions and the civilizations of the Mayas and tribes who have had a lot of press, a lot of exposure for their culture, and I don't mean to diminish the significance of what they've done because I respect it tremendously, especially since many Mayan Indians have come here as refugees in recent years from the injustice that has driven them out of their own land. But those things, I don't know if they're being brought out at all in this exhibit, but that is the true Native American art. But the Native American art of New England, which is more relevant to the area here, it seems like it's been excluded. And I'm curious why more work wasn't done, more research to include that. Joan Lester would have been a great asset because she's worked with us for many years.
Talok, I appreciate your call. Let's put the question right to Elliot. Give us a sense of what we would see in this wing when it comes to Native American art, and what about regionality even within that?
Well, actually, our collection has been built from the beginning when the museum was first founded in the 1870s, but it's harder, frankly, to acquire the work of the northeastern woodlands cultures. It just somehow didn't come down to us. Our own collectors were so much a part of what people collected and gave to us because our purchase funds are so limited. And just historically, I think people didn't feel this material was as interesting to them as when they went out west. They found the cultures of the Plains Indians to be more engaging and dynamic. So while I would say it's been collected, and actually some collectors recently have acquired some superb sashes that are on view in the wing right now that are recent acquisitions from the northeastern woodland, so you will find those. But again, we're working across the whole 400 peoples strong of the Native American cultures, and we have one gallery in which to present that breadth. So we have a lot of gaps. We're admitting that, but we're continuing to work on it.
Describe just a couple more pieces of Native American art that we'll find.
Superb fiber, a great deal of Navajo rugs. We have beadwork, moccasins, and we have all kinds of jewelry that's been recently given from the 19th century, so silver jewelry that's been tooled and encrusted with, of course, native turquoise from the West. And we have Northwest Coast objects that, for many people, to go back to the caller about Joseph Campbell, that sense of the mask that appears in the Northwest Coast potlatch figures, a large glaring eyes that then reappear in ancient Americans and even up in the top floor with artists like Peter Busa. So those kinds of dramatic objects are part of the Native American collections as well.
Holland Carter at the New York Times came by to see the wing and loved it. It's so strong in its content, but also in its concept. The wing itself is throwing its institutional weight behind this idea, this broader American idea. And it's interesting. I'll just quote him. One can imagine arguments growing sharp in the present political climate when opinions about what America was, is, and should be are so polarized and proprietorial. And maybe this is where art itself, he wrote, comes to the rescue. So much about the new America's wing is so startling, stimulating, and beautiful that you just want to lay down your arms. Why fight about it? It's just really something to embrace. Andrew, you must have had some of that sense yourself in the presence of all this wonderful art.
Yes, absolutely. And I think a broader point that we could make is that art speaks to us across cultures and across time. And museums aren't places of conflict. They're places of celebration and communication. And so we see this across the board. We see Islamic art departments, for example, being built at museums to give us a better sense of what Islamic culture is. And the American wing and the American wings across this country are representing ourselves to ourselves, and having conversations about what that means is all to the good.
Well, it's a visceral pleasure. It's an intellectual pleasure, beautiful for the eye to behold, and a real stimulating part of a critical national conversation here as well. And who would have thought? And why not, though? All in a great collection of art, whether it's here in the Boston Museum of Fine Arts New Wing or in your region of the country. Elliot Bostwick Davis with the MFA in Boston. Congratulations, and thank you very much for being with us today. It's just a terrific, beautiful new addition to our national cultural heritage. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Tom, for having me.
And Andrew McClellan at Tufts University, thank you so much for your thoughts and insights today. Great to have you.
Thanks. Great pleasure, Tom.
Listeners right across the country, we are always so happy to hear from you. Thanks for joining us today. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.